Welcome to the Sanctuary Podcast, hosted by Angel Deer. In this podcast, we explore the mysteries of spirituality and consciousness. In each episode, we dive deep into the realms of human experiences, our rapidly changing world, and the unseen realms, tapping into the universal wisdom that connects us all. Whether you're a seasoned spiritual seeker, starting to awaken to the possibilities of a more expansive reality, or want support on your journey, this podcast is for you. Join me as we explore topics such as shamanism, spiritual transformation, holistic healing, the medicine path, energy healing, plant medicine, ancient wisdom, and more. Our guests are respected elders and experts in their fields, and we'll learn from their insights and experiences as we journey together on the path of spiritual growth. If you can, please consider supporting this podcast by joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/thesanctuaryny. Once again, it is patreon.com/thesanctuaryny. Now, let's dive into today's episode.
This idea that survival and wilderness skills and learning our ancestral knowledge is this sole pursuit of a rugged individual is a myth that has been perpetuated for like the last 200 years. I think partially because of, the pioneer days in the Americas, and people really did as Western invaders and settlers into this land that was occupied by Native Americans. They felt alone and that they had to have all the skills themselves to kind of set up a cabin and, set up their farmland and create a ranch. And that was very much, an individual or a family effort for a period of a few decades. And I think sort of mythologized that period in American history and thinking that that's normal thing to do, but it's so not. Every community of humans, of Homo sapiens across the globe has lived in community in nature. And I think this has then been propagated through our fascination for these reality TV shows such as Alone or Naked and Afraid, these shows that depict an individual or just a couple who are struggling valiantly against the threat of nature, and nature is depicted as something that is harmful and it's out to get you, and you have to be the most bold and strong and skilled person in order to defeat it in a way.
Hello everyone, and welcome for this new episode. I'm really excited today to be with Jessica Carrocraft. Hey Jessica, how are you?
Hi, I'm great. Thanks for having me. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, we're going to talk about some of my favorite topics. And we've titled this talk, Why We Need to Be Wild. You are still a hunter-gatherer. And I just love already everything I'm feeling when I'm reading that. But for people joining us here on the podcast or here watching us, let me tell you a little bit more about Jessica. So Jessica is the author of Why We Need to Be Wild, One Woman's Quest for Ancient Human Answers to 21st Century Questions. And Jessica sent me her book, and that's how I heard about it and, started diving into it. And I got really excited about, bringing you here today to have a chat. So I will just read a little part of your bio just for people, put you in a little bit in the context. So you are an independent journalist trained in anthropology, and you have written on health, culture, tech, and education for prominent national and local publications. And in midlife, she learned ancestral skills, became a naturalist, and started wild food foraging. She's also an editor and ghostwriter in the Wellness Place, and she has trained in many different practices. And you can read that in the bio below here. But, I don't like to go too long into bio reading. I'm more interested about talking to you, Jessica.
Yeah, I agree with you too. I think we have a little bit of a cult of credentialism in our culture.
Yes.
So somebody has this degree and that degree and this award and this institute. And it's just like, well, who are they as people? That doesn't really say anything.
Yeah, and don't you feel our best skills and our best, I would say, title are not in those bios in many ways? It's something we cannot really be certified for, or we can't really prove in certain ways, like the Western world wants us to prove things.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
So Why We Need to Be Wild, that's the title from your book. And so I want to talk about this quest. And, you know, before we dive into that topic, I would love to hear about your encounter with this truth. Was this something that obviously you were always like that as a little girl and you just evolved into it? Or were there a moment you kind of got lost away from it and then there was a call back? And we're always interested about what was that calling? What did it look like? And how did you answer it?
Absolutely. What a great question. You can really get at the heart of things. Okay. I would say, so about 8 years ago, I was working in the epicenter of Silicon Valley tech. And this extreme experience of kind of automation and AI and techno utopia, where every single problem that humanity faced, these CEOs and tech startups, founders were saying, like, this is all going to be solved by various apps and digital hardware, et cetera. And I just, you know, it was a moment of like, well, wait a second. No, it's not. Tech has never really solved any human problems. It's actually created more from what I could sort of observe in my own experience. And, you know, even your cell phone, you can't get it to reliably do the things you want it to do. Our cars are always breaking down and our industries are spewing pollution into the air, and nothing about our highly technologized life has made us healthier or happier overall. Right. So, and I know I'm speaking in broad generalizations here and there are exceptions to that, but, as I was seeing more and more this techno optimism, I had an instinct that this was untrue, or at least it was untrue for me, because as I was spending more and more hours in an office under LED lighting, ignoring my basic instincts to be outside, get fresh air, get exercise, eat well, see my children, you know, recreate, I was just like, there's got to be a different way. And I know that tech is so recent in human history. And so, of course, we all know that, you know, 100 years ago, things were dramatically different. And previous generations, even just our grandparents, lived in a way that was a lot more close, you know, closer to nature, closer to their own biorhythms. And so that started this exploration where I can tend to be an extreme person and want to get the absolute, you know, most, I don't know, let's say superlative version of something. And so I was like, well, I want to leave tech and I want to go completely wild. Right. So I wanted to experience those extremes of like working in the epicenter of this and understanding how people were thinking and then who's doing it exactly the opposite way. And so I went in search of rewilders and people who are either bringing back Stone Age technologies or they have been living that way for a long time, reliant on their ancestral skills and living much closer to nature outside a lot more. And they are pushing back against technology and digital interfaces whenever they can, because they see that as a source of disconnection and a lack of health for us. And so that's kind of what happened. But I mentioned the word instinct because I think that I always had as a child an instinct that was more similar to how human societies functioned in the deep, distant past, right? So when we're talking about hunter-gatherer populations of like even 50,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, before agriculture and before civilization, what they have is a strong sense of egalitarianism, that everybody has a right to our basic needs and we are all equal and autonomous. And so it's not that I was always like super nature connected as a child, but I always had this sense that like human relations that are based on hierarchy just seemed wrong to me. They seemed like they were denying humanity. It seemed like denying people a voice or that their ability to make decisions for their own life was, you know, just absolutely not how humans should be. And as and learn more about how hunter-gatherer communities, and once again, making a generalization that kind of proves true through anthropologists' field work. We see that egalitarianism is a central tenet of what it means to be human. And we need to be in small, supportive groups, right, face to face. All of this helps our health, our mental health, our emotions, our productivity, even if you want to get kind of Silicon Valley about it. When we have these small supportive communities, we do better overall, right? So I always had that sense.
Interesting. But, you know, I feel like when we say that, and maybe some people got triggered by the terms or just already have some kind of idea about what that looked like, contemporary people living with Stone Age technology. For people just listening to podcasts, not watching the video here, Jessica is not in a hut right now covered with, you know, animal skins. And she's, you know, living in a house and, you know, you seem to dress, you know, like a normal person, I would say. So what is that way of living that can we define a rewilding in the context of the modern world? Because very often people are like, okay, you want us to go back to Stone Age, right? You want us to get rid of all our technology, which is kind of funny because we are here on a computer, you know, recording this. So what is the balance there? Or what is the place also for rewilding in the context of the modern world? How do we do that without feeling that, okay, well, this is very fringe. This is for very few people, and you're basically asking me to go live in a hut, and nobody wants to go back living in a hut in the wild, right, in some ways. So what is that rewilding term, Stone Age technology in the modern world? How does that work? What does it look like?
Great. Okay. So fantastic question, and something that we absolutely must address. And I have to say, I am not a poster child for rewilding. Right? Like I was a chronicler and an observer of this movement and somebody who became deeply immersed in it and did learn the skills. But I am not, as you said, like I'm not, you know, fully living a Stone Age lifestyle. To my knowledge, there's only, you know, there's extant hunter-gatherers. There are groups of populations around the world from the Hadza in Tanzania to the Warani in Ecuador who are living their original lifestyle or however it's changed in the last millennia, but they, you know, never kind of joined civilization, so to speak, right? So we have those extant hunter-gatherer groups, and one could characterize that with the problematic term Stone Age, or we could say Paleolithic, or we could say, you know, primitive, which is also another term that's contested. And then there are folks in who have grown up with Western values in our modern civilization with everything from, you know, coffee makers to microwaves to televisions, who, for whatever reason, are drawn towards recovering some aspects of Paleolithic life. And so everything that you brought up are sort of like the characterizations, the Flintstone version of what I'm talking about, which I think is you know, that's the surface impression. But the idea here is that we cannot lose these ancestral skills, like making fire with just friction, with just wood, right? Like if and it's for survival reasons too, like if you're caught in the woods and you don't have a lighter with you and you have no way of being warm, it's extremely useful to know how to still make friction fire, right? So there are hundreds, thousands of people who are studying that skill, mastering it, retaining it for either future survival possibilities or the fact that our civilization will collapse at some point in time, right? We know this. This is just inevitable. We just don't know when it will happen. Every previous civilization has collapsed from the Minoan through, you know, Greco-Roman times, the Easter Island. Every civilization has a rise and a fall. And so we're just like many people are looking at ours and saying there are many signs that ours is also approaching collapse. And so retaining these skills is a way of ensuring future human survival in whatever form that takes. The most resilient and longstanding way to survive on this planet is by using foraging skills and our ancestral body of knowledge that is now 300,000 years old. Okay, so when we're talking about how to rewild in the contemporary context, This is about learning some of those skills for your own personal fulfillment if you are motivated to do that, right? There's no kind of global sort of this liberal idea of like everybody must now drive an electric car, right? The rewilding movement is like, if you're drawn toward this and you would like to investigate barefoot running or shelter building or friction fire making or hide tanning, there are resources available to you. Uh-huh. And in no way is there any kind of movement to make everybody do anything. This is just like opening up our options as modern people, looking at our future as a society and saying, what are the skills that we really want to retain as people? Is it the swiping and the tapping and ordering Uber Eats to our house? Is that really the best skill we can work on right now? Or should we also have the skills of basic human survival, face-to-face human connection, health and physical activity outside, right? So when people get scared about it, it's just sort of laughable to me because the fundamental principle, as I said before, is human autonomy. You get to make choices about your life. You get to decide what you want to do. And that is, I will never tell somebody that they need to rewild, right? It's got to be internally motivated.
Uh-huh. So, you know, I definitely feel into the need to kind of take care of our own health, right? Knowing, okay, which plants can I find in the forest that can help me with that elements? What kind of wild food I could forage? Potentially, yeah, I get lost and, you know, I'm going to survive. Do I know how to make shelters? You know, how do I filter water? How do I make fire? But I feel, you know, one of the topic would love you to talk about, I feel, you know, at least for me and many people I've known in that movement, there is an underlying deeper desire, which is a desire for community, a desire for connection. And I put that in the context of a hyper-connected world, right, where we have thousands of connections every day through social media and, you know, the digital world in general, or even living in massive cities. You know, I used to live in New York City, and you encounter millions of people every day, pretty much. But there is no true community. There is not that deep, intimate connection with a group of people. And I feel like a lot of people come to sometimes events where offering trainings around rewilding and foraging and making your own preserved food and things like that, not just to learn the skill, but to be with people that are interested in some topics, to be in community. So can you talk a little bit about that? In the perspective also that many people see this work or rewilding as very like the lone man in the forest, right? Okay, you went to live back in the forest. Someone told me that one day, oh, you left the city and you went to live alone in the forest, right? Out of civilization, which is completely far from the truth. In fact, that's opposite. My community today of people living in my town and people interested in this work is much bigger, tighter than my community was in New York City, at least as more meaning and depth of connection, right? So can you talk about this myth of the lone man or the lone woman in the wilderness in the context of this movement of rewilding and exploring ancient skills?
I just love how you summarized all that. That is, it's you just really spoke the truth that underlying all of this is our primal need for connection and to be seen and, you know, celebrate together and feel supported. And like we have a network of free exchange, because I think in our society today, it's like we have to pay for so much support that a tribal community would offer for free and it would just be reciprocal. So we're getting the therapists and we're getting the medical doctors and we're getting whatever coaches or life, you know, additions to our life that maybe your auntie and your grandma and your uncle and people around you in your community would have done for you, even babysitting, right? You can't get anybody to care for children for free. So I love that you also are talking about how there's this really big divide in terms of building community in rural and urban America, but I think it's also global, it's widespread. And I encountered the same thing. I used to live in San Francisco and in the East Bay, in California. And then I moved out to the Sierra foothills thinking, oh, I will just be alone in the woods in some sort of ironic fashion. And I was like, maybe that's my fate. And then discovered that when you live rurally, you are so much more dependent and in touch with the people around you. So discovering that there was this wonderful community of neighbors that would help me out and that I could help out, bring them eggs from my chickens. They'd bring me firewood. We would gather together sort of in this unintentional community. So I definitely experienced that as well. Uh-huh. And, you know, this idea that survival and wilderness skills and learning are ancestral knowledge is this sole pursuit of a rugged individual is a myth that has been perpetuated for like the last 200 years. I think partially because of, you know, the pioneer days in the Americas, and people really did as Western invaders and settlers into this land that was occupied by Native Americans. They felt alone and that they had to have all the skills themselves to kind of set up a cabin and, you know, set up their farmland and create a ranch. And that was very much, you know, an individual or a family effort for a period of a few decades. And I think we sort of mythologized that period in American history in thinking that that's a normal thing to do, but it's so not. Every community of humans, of Homo sapiens across the globe, has lived in community in nature. And it's actually kind of a tragic or difficult, or it's a rite of passage when one sole person goes out into the wilderness from that tribe, right? It's, you know, the vision of many Native American groups, or it's, you know, some sort of tragic thing has happened where people have to survive. But optimally, humans live together. And I think this myth has then been propagated through our fascination for these reality TV shows, such as Alone or Naked and Afraid, these shows that depict an individual or just a couple who are struggling valiantly against the threat of nature. And nature is depicted as something that is harmful and it's out to get you. And you have to be the most bold and strong and skilled person in order to defeat it in a way, right? So it sets up this sort of dichotomy of nature bad, human good. Also that only the superior humans are able to survive in nature. And all of this is completely false. And it's not shown in anthropological evidence of any human community, right? So Ishi, have you heard of Ishi, the last Yahi Indian of Central California, right? So his entire tribe was massacred by white settlers and ranchers in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And he was so decimated. I mean, he was like a 40-year-old man, had grown up completely surviving off of the land. But once his tribe was gone, there was no purpose, no meaning, no ability to survive the way he knew how to survive. And so Ishi, the lone man in the wilderness, comes down off the mountain he was on and joins civilization because his primal need was for human connection. So I think just even that story shows us that even the most skilled Native American is incapable and doesn't want to be alone in the wilderness.
Mm. Yeah, I felt, you know, it's like parenting, like grieving, like building your own house, like hunting or gathering for food. All of the things, we've done them for hundreds of thousands of years in community. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And here we are in this modern world when none of that needs is through community, right? You can just go online and order your food. You can just go to the supermarket for it. You're told as a mother, and well, we'll talk a little bit more about parenting, but you have to do it on your own, right? It's a, this is your job, right? Where parenting was very much a community-based skill and task. And it still is for many communities around the world. Your house, you're not going to build your house, right? You're just going to hire people that have that skills, right? And you're going to pay for it. When I am in Peru, in the communities up in the mountain, obviously because of the difficulty to have access to materials, because you're far and remote communities, everybody help everybody, right? So you might help me to build my house, which means I'm going to help you harvest your corn, which means maybe someone is going to help take care of the kids, right? There is interdependence and interconnectedness in every aspect of life. So much that even in the Quechua language, in the ancient Inca language, there is not a word for mine or my. You know, you can say, this is my house, this is my bag, this is my, even my car or my TV, it's ours. It's always a we. It's so, you know, deep ingrained in the people that they don't have a word for it. There is not that sense of property because everything you have is shared. So there is no need for the word, right? And it's very hard to translate and explain our view of the world the way we as Westerners live and relate, because we have a word that doesn't exist in their language, right? But that's how deep it is in the culture. And you know, and I want to share to people here that those cultures, they have cars, they have solar panels. You know, it's not like they are out of the world completely, but they still somehow have kept alive a way of relating that can be experienced at least by Westerners, you know. And I want to share, this is not me as a tourist visiting, this is me spending 3 to 6 months every year for the past 15 years. So having a long experience and still not knowing, you know, their life fully, because I don't live there permanently and I'm not from that culture, but where I can see a level of fulfillment, of individual joy that I rarely experience anywhere else, but in that type of community. I experienced that in Peru, in the jungle, too, in the Amazonian forest. I experienced that in other type of communities that have to rely on each other for all of that. And my experience, you know, I was sharing that with someone that's a big CEO in New York City at the moment that I'm doing one-on-one work with, that has all the needs fulfilled, let's say. Has the money, she has the career, she has the house here, the house in the Hamptons. She literally have everything, but she's was sharing with me, and she has a huge company with over 1,000 employees. She was sharing with me how lonely she feels in her life. How she felt to a certain degree that she's living a lie, and she cannot really put a pinpoint where that is from. You know, where is this coming, this sensation, because she has ticked all the boxes of what society is expecting, and somehow this belonging is not there. And I was sharing about, yeah, that being that we are, that has evolved around hundreds of thousands of years with certain needs, and she's a little bit like a potted tree. You know, there's nothing wrong with a tree, right? But if you take most of the trees, if you try to grow them in a pot inside your house, they're going to struggle. And as human being, I feel we often think, well, there must be something wrong with me, because I'm not experiencing this level of fulfillment and joy that I've been told should be present if I do that. So can we talk a little bit about us as the potted tree in some ways? I mean, I think so many people are experiencing that today, right? Looking at the world and what's happening, feeling that something wrong about them and why they don't feel so fulfilled in that life despite their everything. And we rarely question civilization. We rarely question the moles. I mean, maybe if you're listening here to this and if you're present in this talk so far, I'm sure you're probably questioning it to a certain degree, right? But can you talk about that? Yeah, the problem not being the person or the potted tree, but the pot, the soil, the community, basically, and what's in what we are in relation to, right?
Yes. So I would say all of us are suffering because of our separation from our community and from nature, right? And some theorists, you know, Gabor Mate, he says we all have this sort of PTSD, this deep trauma from being separated from that evolved nest. We can look at how human communities function when we're not in civilization, right? And it is that the medicine of the community, of the social support, of multiple people filling these roles for you and you having your own role in that community that's clearly defined, that is what keeps us healthy. And social isolation, we're finding out now, is, you know, it's as unhealthy for you as smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. So because we're wired for connection, we are social animals, right? And you look at other groups of social mammals, and they're always together, right? The ground squirrels climbing on top of each other, the mice that live in community, even ants, right? There are a lot of organisms that are ultra social, which is what the theorist John Gowdy calls them. So this idea that we have completely separated from our evolutionary blueprint, and that is making us miserable, and our capitalist industrial society benefits from us being separated, right? Because then it can sell our needs back to us through these video games, through the self-medication of any addictive substance, you name it, whether it's alcohol or marijuana or prescription drugs. Netflix, one of the more benign ones. But, right, and us all living in individual houses that all require a refrigerator and a washing machine and several beds and televisions, all of this is making money for the hierarchy. And it's separating us more and more, but yet we can't escape it because it is a form of slavery, in my opinion, right? Where like we're enslaved to all these objects. We have to keep consuming. We have to keep working in order to afford them. And then any need that we come up with from our emotional vacuum, whether it's this loneliness, this depression, or any number of the mental health ailments that we have nowadays that hunter-gatherers do not suffer at all, right? That requires a paid solution. Most mainstream therapists do focus on the individual as the problem, like you're saying. It's, you know, you haven't found a way to deal productively with conflict, or you separated part of your soul as a child, and so you're not in touch with your inner child, and you're unable to access these playful parts of yourself. There's so many narratives that we're told about ourselves through therapy and through the self-help industry, where it's like, there's something wrong with me and I need to go and do the work to fix it, without saying, like you're pointing out, that it's a structural issue. We're all potted plants, or we're all animals in captivity. This is a giant zoo experiment of civilization. And we know that animals in zoos, while they have more longevity, they get sicker more often, they get depressed. Like, whoever heard of a depressed lion out in the savannah, right? Like, that just doesn't happen. But in the zoo, you could actually get that. And we are in a zoo of our own making here. So I love your analogy of the potted tree. I'm going to adopt that. I'm going to steal that from you. But it's absolutely true that the most powerful medicine is that safety, soothing, that support, and that being seen that we feel in community, where people know you and you have a role. And I would guess that your CEO client, you know, she's just been chasing this ladder of success, which is what the cultural script tells her to do, right? But it may not have been what her own inner compass was pointing her towards. And so she followed a script that wasn't true to herself. And now she's also looking at the gap between those two things, and finding out, like, oh, this isn't a fulfilling role for me at all. And unfortunately, a lot of people feel this. I felt that. And I think that through understanding rewilding, understanding our origins as a hunter-gatherer community in support of each other, it's helped me not say I'm the problem. I mean, certainly I am in some ways, but rather it's this social structure we have, which is killing us and which is harming us in incredible ways. And we do have to work to resist that and come together.
Yeah. So, you know, when you're sharing about that, I feel there is just this giant machine, systemic capitalistic world that is not going to let go, obviously, of consumption, because that's how it survives, not going to let go of isolation, because that's how it needs, what it needs for thriving, and promises a little bit what you started with, oh, but there is this new app, or there is this new technology, and there's going to be this new product where you are going to finally feel that connection, that return to, you know, somehow this world. So much that maybe we might use those alternate reality glasses in order to immerse ourselves back into a wild world because we don't have access to it. And we keep disconnecting. So, I want to be a little bit, be the devil's advocate here. How do we, from that perspective, knowing we are living in this world, it sounds very utopian to go towards what you're describing. Obviously, you're preaching to the choir here. So, I'm not dismissing what you're saying. But I want to talk a little bit about the resistance that are there. And you talk a little bit about it in the system, but also the resistance that might come up for each individual to reclaim that, because we carry the systems within us, right? So there's going to probably be fear about stepping back into that. And I feel, and at least that's what I've observed with most people, we usually double down on what we've been doing so far. Let's try to get more money. Let's try to wait for retirement to do that. Let's try to, get thicker. And until we are really sick, we might not make the decision. So we're kind of often waiting for what's called a midlife crisis. This moment where the disconnection between the inner self and the outer self is so wide that we have no choice, and we get healed, we get sick, we get depressed, something really big happened, to kind of say, yeah, that makes sense. I'm going to return to that. So can you talk a little bit more about that aspect of the inner challenge and resistance? And how do we address that? How do we do that rewilding? I'm a CEO in New York. I'm an executive in that company working in Silicon Valley, right? And I spent quite a lot of time there in a previous life, I would say, raising money for my startup, right? So if we are there and we're feeling like, yeah, we have all those things, but we still crave that, but we are so afraid or resistant, which could be social pressure, what people are going to think, or even, not knowing, how to address that, how to bring that into this modern context.
Okay, yeah. Well, I have to say, it's kind of bringing up my egalitarian impulse, where I'm like, it's hard for me to empathize a lot with people who've had so much extreme privilege, right?
Okay, we agree with that. Yeah. Don't worry about that.
When we've got so many people who don't even have access to nature, right? Like urban communities where the rates of asthma are like approaching 50-60%, or all of Singapore, where 90% of the children are now, myopic, right? They can't read without glasses because they've been in these interior spaces and on screens their entire lives, and it's changed the structure of their eye. Sorry, it's a little triggering for me. I hate that word, to try to help these folks who've been in control of all the power and resources for so long. And then now they want to access nature and their inner self. And yes, everyone deserves that. So maybe that's what I come back to, is that we are all hunter-gatherers by our DNA, our bodies, our minds, our spirits. Right. When we look at the DNA of folks that we're discovering in the ground in Northern Africa from even 360,000 years ago, right, there are so few differences in the genetic code, even in the bone structure, that we can say we have been this one species that has survived hunting and gathering and living outside in nature in small nomadic groups. We have been that for so long, and we are not fundamentally different from them, even though. We may look different. There's a lot of surface sort of cosmetic things, lighter skin, smaller jaws, crooked teeth. And all of that is because we are at a mismatch with our evolutionary blueprint. We're not eating the foods or getting the stress to our jaw that we need. So anyway, we're all hunter-gatherers. And we all, if we can recognize that, can feel our inner instincts, which is to be outside more, to be face-to-face in connection with community, to feel supported, soothed, and loved, and to have a role. So I think for people who are feeling that resistance, it's all about creating that universal connection with people and really taking the macroscopic view of humanity. And so when we're dealing with these personal conflicts of what will other people think of me? Well, everybody likes a good party, you know? Everybody likes to laugh together and do a ceremony or a ritual in whatever tradition that you're coming from. Like, we all like that. And so I think for folks who are struggling to think about how to get into rewilding, pulling that lens back, looking at what in your life is already very connected to our human history, right? Mm. And then emphasizing that, producing more of that. So I'm part of the community here, and I've spent 3 years now trying to build a group of folks, you know, and it's there have been hits and misses, right? So like people who come and we get very committed to each other, and then something breaks down and they leave, and then folks who have been sort of by my side for the last 3 years who I've been helping, and you know, having conversations with people about how important community is and being open and honest about your vulnerability. I think if this CEO, you know, just confided in a few people about what she's going through internally, she would find a lot more connection. But yet she doesn't want to seem vulnerable. She doesn't want to admit to her basic human needs, perhaps. I mean, I'm just making this up, but this is what I've seen as well. Mm-hmm. And yet by sharing with other people like, hey, I'm really needing community. I am a solo mom living alone in the woods. I need help with my kids. I need help with my land. I need, you know, this and this. And what can I do for you? I'm willing to be a reciprocal partner. And so through these, you know, open communication, saying what my needs are, which is grounded in an understanding of our shared humanity, I'm starting to see a lot more people kind of showing up, invitations to potlucks on the land, you know, like all this great stuff that you're talking about happened with you, and you building your amazing sanctuary community there. So long-winded answer. But the way we get through that resistance is by being vulnerable and admitting our true human needs and then finding connection with other people around those.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, you know. And yeah, I do recognize obviously it's a need from everyone and not just the privilege. And in fact, not most of the privilege need that, more, you know, massive communities which are underprivileged need that and don't have access to that, right? From healthy food to connection to nature and all of that. But I was thinking, you know, also the people in power, people that have the power to change things for thousands or millions, you know, and right, that are trapped into this capitalistic view of the world of separation and greed and extraction, which is harming everyone, including themselves, obviously, ultimately, and their own family down the generations to come, right? I want to talk about that a little bit, about the children and the parenting and the generation to come. We've put, I'm going to continue with that analogy of potted trees, right? We're putting our children into classrooms that are very sterile under this LED light, like you mentioned that you were in, very often very disconnected from nature. There are now hundreds, if not thousands, of studies about the benefit of nature for schooling. Different type of school for children that has massive impact on their mental health. Kids are much more healthy. They don't have ADHD. They don't have those traits of violence and that we experience in the kind of the more Western way of seeing education. So I want to ask you, to you as a mom and as your experience as a parent, about rewilding parenting, the necessity of it, what you've seen and what parents that are listening, you know, are experiencing with their children, and what can be done to provide, making sure that our kids don't forget those skills, making sure that our kids grow healthy mental bodies, emotional bodies through that kind of life, at least a part of their life as those aspect embedded into it.
I mean, it's a huge topic.
Yeah, it's a huge area, right? Obviously, yeah, we're not going to go through all of it here.
Yeah. Well, I think it's always good to focus on the positive. And like you said, there is a flourishing of these wilderness skills camps and education institutes for kids in most urban areas. I've been able to find places that will you know, teach the skills of friction fire and tracking and foraging and plant identification, nature immersion. Unfortunately, a lot of those schools are available mostly to kids of privilege, whose parents, you know, have flexible schedules where they can pick them up and drop them off at different times. But yet, that it's still a powerful cultural force. And we do see within our structured kind of governmentally run education system, a lot more school gardens, a lot more tearing up of the asphalt on playgrounds and planting edibles and, you know, greenery so that the kids are using, you know, getting those benefits of being exposed to raw nature, right? Even on their 10-minute recess breaks. Nutrition is changing in the schools. I think there's a lot of great direction that we're going in. It's obviously not enough. It's not quick enough. And then there is a counterforce, which is, you know, teaching kids coding at age six, getting them really excited about technology. In my opinion, I don't think that's where children should be focused when they're 6 years old, 7 years old. I think they should be. And this is a directive, because we can see that the benefits are clear, like you're saying. They should be exposed to the outdoors and learning skills and playing with each other and having that physical agility that comes from climbing trees and fording creeks and hopping from puddle to puddle. It's amazing to me that kids and adults are losing so many physical skills and capabilities that we had just a couple generations ago. And that is because we're forcing them to sit in those desks, stay inside, ruin their eyesight with the screens and the LED lights. And, you know, when I go into parks with my children, it's amazing to me when I see other kids and they're like afraid to step on a log, or, you know, they don't want to cross a creek by stepping on stone because they're going to get wet. There's this overriding fear and then lack of physical agility. And I think that's also a problem. Right. So how do we attack that with our, or not attack, but rather address that with parenting? And I think for me, it's come down to making nature the center of our family values. And I mean, and it's things like making sure there's a plant in every room of our house, right? Just a little symbolic effort to stay connected to nature, even though it's a potted plant. And I know we've had our problems with that, but this idea of like, let's have an indoor outdoor life. Even if it's cold outside, we're going to get out. We're going to do activities out there. Even if it's incredibly hot, we're going to take a section of the day and be outside and deal with that discomfort. Uh-huh. You know, my kids are normal kids who have resisted me saying, let's go for a hike. Let's go for a bike ride. And it's taken a lot of inner strength for me to keep pushing that and to know that I am their guide in this life. And I know that getting outside is much better for them than staying in. So for parents, it's about developing that kind of internal strength to push against your kids when they're like, no, I need to stay in and play Minecraft or whatever the complaint is for why they don't want to get outside. Addressing that in yourself, working through that resistance you have to helping your kids get outside. And then, you know, it comes down to also these social ideas about what is it to raise a young hunter-gatherer, which is what our kids actually are inside. Even though we're molding them as members of civilization, they still have all those instincts and they may be closer to them than we even are as adults. Mm-hmm. So some modifications, some things I've done that I've found some success with, which are very unorthodox, are that I have not allowed my kids to have their own rooms or even much of their own stuff. Like you're talking about the Quechua. We have three rooms that might be considered bedrooms, but somebody's clothes are in one and somebody's bed is in another and somebody's desk and work area. So our space is very fluid and there isn't this idea of like, you can just go isolate in your room. You know, I have refused to allow my kids to just go isolate in their room where they're not in the social fabric of our family, or to see one space as theirs or even one thing as theirs. Sure, they'll fight over, my kids are really into music right now, they'll fight over the guitars. But it's not like one guitar is one child. It's like, this is our family stuff. This is all ours. So, you know, and that's a very deeply ingrained American cultural phenomenon that each child has their room and they can escape to their room and isolate. But I've seen that become so negative for family life, right? And it kind of leads to the disconnect, especially in adolescence, between parents and children. Mm-hmm. don't know if you want me to say more.
Yeah, tell me a bit more about that. I think it's a very interesting thing. And probably a lot of people are like, oh my God, that sounds bad. And that's not nice. And, you know, it's like you're depriving them from their space and from their things, you know, because we're so attached to our stuff, right? And yeah. I feel like, you know, they're, yeah, people might be like, is this really good for the kids, right?
Yeah. I mean, I welcome people to ask those questions and then look at how human societies function apart from our Western society. And you'll see, you know, most people sleep in beds together, right? There aren't isolated beds across the world. And it's a matter of poverty in some cases, but it's also a matter of like, we're mammals who like to cuddle together at night, just like every other mammal. So, you know, I understand, you know, that's part of our huge disconnect in civilization from our mammalian, our biological origin, right? Like we like to sleep together in groups. We like to have communal property. We like to all participate in meals. So this idea that like a parent makes a meal and then the child comes and eats it and the child doesn't really have any responsibility for food is completely alien to human evolution, right? Like, no, children need to be learning about food from when they can walk, from when they can kind of be separate individuals. They've got to be involved in the food process. So whether that's, you know, and I think a lot of parents do this, mm-hmm. but then it comes to like, oh, well, the kitchen gets really messy. It's too much hassle to allow them to cook or clean up. And so I want to challenge that as well. Like, why is being clean the supreme value of your household? Why isn't it togetherness? Why isn't it teaching your children how to prepare food and how to be autonomous with their energy needs, right? So just kind of questioning how we're orienting our family life, I think is also really important. So I love it when my kids get involved in food production. And I don't care if the kitchen is messy for a couple of hours because we did it together. We made this soup that we're all proud of. And then, you know, other little hacks. One day, you know, my kids were very resistant to getting outside. And I happened, you know, this is lucky of me that I'm privileged. I have a solar powered battery pack, right? Something I got at a camping store. And so when they refused to come outside, I was like, well, I'm moving the router outside. So there's nothing you can do. If you want to access internet, you have to sit outside with your computer because you're not going to get any more Wi-Fi in. So I think getting creative and not completely limiting your children, you know, from screen time or from candy or from the tantalizing aspects of our society and culture today. But just making sure that they know the primary value is nature and it's social connection. And if we can do that in big and small ways, I think that goes a long way to healing our separation.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I really feel it deep in my bone and I can see the beauty of it. And yeah. So Jessica, I want to finish our talk by talking a little bit about your book, Why We Need to Be Wild, your quest for ancient human answers for the 21st century big question. So can you talk to us a little bit about the book, you know, and what people will find in it, you know, and if they want to go deeper, also anything else that you want to mention to work with you or, but yeah, the content of the book for people that would be interested probably to go deeper into all the topics we've talked about today.
Great. Thank you for that opportunity to talk about it. Yeah. The book came out August, 2023. It's going to be out in paperback as of June 18th, 2024. It is an immersive nonfiction account of my attempt to learn wild skills, ancestral skills, weaves anthropology and archaeology of ancient human cultures and how we functioned in those nomadic groups. And then I spent a lot of time with communities who are also perpetuating those ancestral skills. I met individuals who are on the extreme end of rewilding. So people who are trying to maybe hunt and gather all of their food, or they are trying to live without any modern technology. They're roaming the Western countryside, replanting native plants on the paths of indigenous folks from hundreds of years ago. And through these journeys and my own attempts to learn the skills, I kind of come to a new understanding of what my point in life is, right? Coming earlier from working in tech to now, how can I embed myself in nature and raise a family that has nature at the center of its life, of our life? So the book feedback I've gotten is that it's very helpful for folks who are sort of on the questioning side of thinking, gosh, I don't really like my job, or I don't really agree that I should be shopping in a grocery store for all my food, or I don't like taxes. I don't like dealing with bureaucracies and explosion of paperwork. If you're feeling any points of resistance as to like why our society is this way and why so many of us are sick and isolated and depressed and underslept and stressed out, this book can kind of walk you through a new path and a new way of thinking about all of these pain points that we encounter in contemporary life. So I'm hopeful that, you know, we'll get more readers. And ultimately for me, the book is about, like you said, building community, building a group of like-minded folks who will together build a better world, who will be more nature connected, raise these kids who can connect to each other in very deep ways and connect to the earth. So it's got some big goals, but it's also a story. There's humor. There's, you know, a divorce. There's real life things that happen in the book. So I think there's something for everybody.
Thank you. Yeah, I really enjoy it. And, you know, I'm streak water through it. I'm almost, you know, done with it, but I really learn a lot, even me that have, you know, explore all these topics. I love the way you approach the topics, and also it's very well researched, which I like. You know, it's not just based on your own experience, but the experience of a lot of people and a lot of traditions. So if people want to go more deeply into that, obviously they can read your books. Do you offer workshops, trainings? You know, is this something you're looking at doing at some point, like guiding people into certain processes or anything else you might want to tell people to look into and to work with that kind of skills or work with you?
Yeah, well, I do events. Yeah, mostly in my local area because I'm very committed to, you know, building community and support here. So in the Sierra Foothills in Northern California, I do have workshops. Those are available on my website, which is my full name, jessicacarewcraft.com. But then I also encourage people, like I mentioned before, there are wilderness and ancestral skills camps and schools all over the country. There are ancestral skills gatherings. I'm about to go to one next week, a couple hours from my house. It's called the Buckeye Gathering. There are at least 30, possibly 40 ancestral skilled gatherings happening across the US. They're also in Europe, and Israel, South America. And I think going to some of these gatherings can be one of the most powerful immersions in, you know, you get a digital detox, you get away from technology, and then you also get to learn some of these very basic human skills while you are kind of replicating a hunter-gatherer community by camping outside and living with people and eating communally. So that's my number one recommendation for folks, is to try to get yourself to an ancestral skills gathering.
Yeah, this is very important. And obviously, we're trying to recover community skills, not just individual skills, and that has to be done in community. And like you said, there are a lot more gathering today than there was even 15 or 20 years ago. There are a lot of people in, you know, I'm sure in any county in the U.S., you can find the one person that has, you know, some of the skills and usually teaching it, and very happy to share about it. Thank you so much, Jessica. It was really such a pleasure to be with you this morning and to discuss. Thank you to everyone that is listening here, watching the video. Please, keep building this community at your own level. Start small. That's also one of the, you know, advice I have. Sometimes it can feel very overwhelming. But that one thing, like you said, maybe it's just a gathering of people eating together. It's just one circle of women together. I mean, one skill. But that's usually what gets you in the way of it, of the experience of this belonging, this connection, how nurturing it is for the soul, how nourishing it is for our life, for our spirit, for our bodies. And that's usually when you want more of it. It's like a really good chocolate, right? I say, you know, just have a little piece of it and you're probably going to want more. Thank you so much, Jessica. Yeah, have a blessed rest of the day. And thank you so much for sharing all this wisdom with us. And for everyone who want to go more, you can find the detail about Jessica's book, Why We Need to Be Wild, One Woman's Quest for Ancient Human Answers to 21st Century Question. Look in the link below this video or this audio. And yeah, get her book and dive more into it. Thank you so much, Jessica.
Thank you. That was great.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Sanctuary Podcast. We deeply value your support. Please consider sharing this podcast with others and joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/thesanctuaryny. Once again, it is patreon.com/thesanctuaryny. At The Sanctuary, we believe that spirituality is a personal journey that takes many forms, and we honor and respect all paths to awakening and the rise of consciousness. Our mission is to provide a platform for open and honest conversations about spirituality and to inspire and empower our listeners to live their most authentic lives in good relation to each other's, the living and invisible worlds. I look forward to connecting with you again here or at our events, retreats, and online gatherings. You can find all our offerings at thesanctuaryheal.com. Once again, it is thesanctuaryheal.com.